everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month.
So, my manga of the month this time around is Go For It Nakamura, which is a one-volume manga from Seven Seas, and it's sort of like a nostalgia throwback rom-com. It's very like late 80s, early 90s style humor and character designs, and it's just a lot of fun. It's a really sweet and funny BL series. It's also, I feel like, a good BL manga if you've never read any BL before, because it's just very like simple and very funny.
Yeah, when I saw it, your write-up for it, I was like, wait, is this an old series that Kate just went back to read, or like just got licensed, even though it's old? Like, oh, well, this author's other title is popular. Or is it like specifically done in a retro style?
And it is. It's from the like mid-2000s. Like, it was also this manga that was kind of like a replacement in the magazine when things didn't make it. So it had a weird schedule and it was very sporadic.
I remember Rumikio Takahashi had like a prototype before Lum that was the same thing. It was just like a stopgap series. So that there are a bunch of series that do that. Like, this only comes out when somebody else in the magazine falls behind and they have to fill the space. Speaking of filling in the space, we'll be filling in a lot of space this season with both SWAT reviews and case closed reviews. When this comes out, we'll definitely have out all the case closed reviews, and we'll probably have at least some, if not most, of the SWAT reviews out. But if not, always pay attention. We'll be watching some of the new shows in this season.
And on the heels of that is our awards post for the summer shows that finished up. And so it's all, you know, our favorites from that. And also in November, we'll do a pre-con podcast, but we are going to be at Anime NYC here in New York City for its second year. I think both of us this year are going for all 3 days, which is different than last year. And it's supposed to be a bigger, even bigger, because it had a really good first year.
And with any luck, we'll get to meet Amara Ray. Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing.
Okay, so our ongoing investigations this month is going to be a little shorter, just because we also went to New York Comic Con and we recorded a big part two section of the Speakeasy. So just keeping this side a little bit shorter so that the podcast is not 3 hours long.
Plus, you know, everybody wants to know about what we did. I know, no, they don't, but
they do. That's why we did it.
I see.
So I want to talk a little bit about, it's kind of multiple things that I have done and seen that are all related to each other, but I haven't done all of them at the same time. It'll make sense when I'm talking about it. But so I recently read one of Keigo Higashino's mystery novels. So this is a big mystery novelist in Japan, and a number of his stories are translated into English. And Malice is the book that I read, and it features one of his famous detectives that he's done a bunch of novels of, Detective Kaga. So This is actually the fourth book of the Detective Kaga novels, but it's the only one thus far translated into English, so I couldn't read the first ones. And I chose this one because there is a bunch of different ones, or a bunch of different mysteries from Mr. Higashino in English, but when I went to Japan on the plane, I watched a live-action movie called The Crimes That Bind, or When the Curtain of Prayer Descends, and that was based on one of the Detective Kaga novels. So I had, like, seen this live-action movie, I liked it, and then I was like, oh, I really want to actually read one of these books, so that's how this... So I'm talking both about that movie and this book that I read. And that movie is the ninth book, or it's based on the ninth book, and there's only 9 novels of this, even though it's been running since the 80s, and the last one was in 2013. So I don't know if there is any more planned. There are pretty big gaps between them, so it's possible another Detective Kaga mystery will, you know, come out. So the movie was great, and I wish I could see more because I think the actor who played Kaga was, like, so great, and I liked that the mystery is kind of, from reading the book and from seeing this movie, it feels like the way the Detective Kaga mysteries are structured is that it's kind of about the motive. Like, that's the big, like, okay, here's this crime, and maybe the crime is weird or, like, whatever, but the big thing that he is often trying to figure out is, like, this very complex motive and backstory of the character and, like, what led them to this place. So that, in that way, it kind of reminds me of Kendaichi Case Files, where it's like, sure, yeah, maybe it's like a locked room or like something weird happened or whatever, and like that's part of the mystery, but the big thing is like, here, let me tell you the giant backstory of this character and why they did it. So I don't know if all of the mysteries are like that, but the two that I have gotten to experience are very much about the motive, and it's not really very difficult to figure out like who did it. So I was actually kind of surprised because in both cases, I thought that I was not going to really like it because I often do not like detective novels where we know who did it and it's just about like catching them. In both cases, the backstory was so compelling and it was so complex that I was sitting there going like, what? Why? Like, why? How does this get, you know, from point A to point B? And so I did end up really enjoying it a lot more than I thought that I would. As a detective, like, I felt like in the book, since I had seen a movie first, of course I'm picturing the actor, and so I feel like that added a lot for me because the book's structure was like half from the perspective of a suspect and half from Detective Kaga's point of view. And so I also really often do not like having perspectives of like other characters or possible like, oh, possibly the criminal. Don't like that either. But still, I was still compelled to read. Kaga is very, like, he's very meticulous detective, not very like staunch or cold or violent or anything like that. He's just meticulous, and he's, what I like about him best is that he just feels like a very curious, like, he's like, he just wants to know, like, that's his sort of personality as I see it.
But he's also not a hunch guy. Or would you?
That's a good question. No, he is because he does in both instances have to kind of go to his chief and be like, I know that this sounds like it doesn't make any sense and that you think you have the answer, but like, please, like, just trust me. I have to figure this out. And like, one of the things, especially in the book Malice, basically they get a whole confession and everything, and like, the killer, like, basically, like, lays it all out. They did it. Here it is. Here's why. Here's everything. And Detective Kago's like, this person did it, but that's not why they did it. And so, like, again, like, his curiosity is like, no, I'm not satisfied with this. Like, it, that is not why this happened. And so, like, figuring out, like, all the details and wanting to, like, dot all the I's is sort of his way, I think. As far as the movie, I really wish I could see more of these movies, if there are any. I loved the actor who played Detective Kaga. Also, it was pretty great because in the movie, he's a Japanese guy, but he is 6'2". So, like, he's, like, so tall in this movie. And, like, they make a big deal about how tall he is in the movie and make, like, jokes about it. But it's, like, I mean, it looks pretty significant in the movie. So I just thought that was, like, an amusing little touch.
So you probably don't, but I'm curious. Do you know if there's any major differences between the ninth book and the movie? Or that's a good question, Al.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, one of the things that was really cool about that particular story, at least in the movie, and I would be interested to know how much, I assume this is in the book, but, like, that movie has a lot about, there's, like, the central present mystery, and then there's also sort of a side mystery about Detective Kaga's past and his mother, and it sort of, like, overlaps in a certain way. And so I feel like you got to know a lot about him because of that, like, it being partially personal. Whereas, like, the fourth book, in the book version that I read, there was nothing, you know, that was, like, really interconnected to his own life or character. So, I thought that was, like, a really interesting touch.
One other question. How much did you feel you were missing out not reading, you know, books 1 through 3 and then 5 through 8?
I feel as though I might not have, like, I already sort of had a picture of Detective Kaga in my mind from reading or from watching that movie, and I had a feeling about his personality. So it's a little hard for me to say because I went in with at least some knowledge, whereas I think I would have normally always wanted to read book one, even if you don't read every mystery from a detective story. I feel like book one usually introduces them in some way that, like, more fully examines them or fleshes them out before kind of assuming you know stuff. I think maybe the reason they picked Malice as the book to be in English, although there is a second mystery in coming out in English in November of this year, which I will absolutely be reading, but it's like the 8th one or something. It's not in order at all. But I think they picked Malice because of what's a seemingly very straightforward murder is, like, way more complicated in ways that you wouldn't expect. Not that there's, like, a big conspiracy and a bunch of people involved. It's just, like I said, all about the motive and just, like, how you follow that sort of uncovering. So I think maybe that's why they picked that one. But having no familiarity at all with any of the others, I just don't have a sense of, you know, why that was, like, the best one to introduce you. It came out, but it did come out a number of years ago, that English translation, so it's also possible, I don't remember how many were out at the time and things like that, but I think you still get that sense of curiosity from Detective Kaga. I don't know if you get, like, a lot of else about him from the book. I feel like you do get that. I have to know all the answers.
So one other quick question. Has he aged, or have they kind of kept it generally around the same time as the first book?
Oh, because the first ones came out in the 80s?
Yeah. I guess the fourth book, because, like, you know, the movie might have just updated. I don't know.
Yeah, that's... Well, so the movie is based on... The movie that I saw is based on the most recent book. So that was 2013. So, like, that one wouldn't have a hard time, you know, like, it didn't feel as though, I mean, in the book, there's no cell phones. Because, like, there's, like, a whole phone. The phone and, like, the fax machine, like, play parts in sort of, like, how the crime was committed. So there's no cell phones in there. Now I'm trying to remember in the movie, like, how much... I feel like in the movie, I didn't get the sense that it was in the far distant past or, like, in a decade past or anything like that. So maybe they've kept it more modern. So when I read the book in November, which is, like, a much later book that actually happens in, like, the 2000s, I'll be able to assess, like...
Excellent.
What the level of technology... It's a good question.
And it wasn't like he was like, young guy in one book and then old grizzled guy.
Right. In the movie, he's like probably like, you know, 30s, late 30s, maybe 40s. Like he's, yeah. So he wasn't, okay. He wasn't like a grizzled old guy, but he wasn't like a new rookie or anything like that. So I don't think that the movie is really all like that available. I just happened to get to watch it on the plane because we were on a Japanese airline, but it's called The Crimes That Bind, and it was great. And then the book that I read, which is the fourth book, but the only one out in English so far, is called Malice, and it's by Keigo Higashino.
It's time to make this podcast popular again.
You mean me talking about detectives is not going to make it?
Sorry. They're going to call it the analytics and downloads prove the way to make this podcast get good numbers is to talk about My Hero Academia. And since we only had one thing this month, me and my roommate went to see the My Hero Academia movie, My Hero Academia 2 Heroes. And... so this one basically takes place...
Hold on, I already have a question.
Yes.
Is it the first movie that they've done? Okay.
So this is the first My Hero Academia movie. And they basically put it like in between the license arc and then before the next arc. So they've gotten their license, who's passed the license arc, and who hasn't is already determined. But it's before that fight with Bakugo and the next, and before them meeting the big three. In fact, they even had like a like anime original opening just to like cement where it is in the timeline. And then like, oh, we're gonna go for a week to, you know, this Eye Island. And then it ends and basically has a preview for the movie. So it's very distinctly in the anime timeline of where it happens. But the general premise is that All Might and Deku go to this Eye Island, which is this man-made, like, roaming island that is filled with, like, super scientists and superheroes who help them out. And there's going to be, like, a big technology expo there. And since All Might is friends with one of, like, the most brilliant scientists, because when he was, you know, when he studied America, he befriended this dude. And so they're going to meet and catch up. And so they go. At first, it seems like only All Might and Deku are going to be there. But eventually you find out that they're some fan favorite characters there as well. It's interesting. There's like a bunch of characters that are like the main characters, but they're not that many. It's like Bakugo, the kid who can turn his skin to rock, Todoroki, Uchako, and the girl who can have things pop out of her.
No Froppy?
She like makes a cameo appearance, but she is not in the main action. Oh, and the class president guy. So they're all there, and they all have like excuses. Like the class president guy there is because his family is famous, and since his brother obviously is out of the action, he's there. And the girl who makes items, her family is rich, so she's there. And Bakugo was there because, God forbid, they don't have Bakugo in the movie. What would they do?
I'm actually interested to see if they up his appearances in the anime, because in the next couple of arcs, he's not in it that much.
Mm-hmm.
Like later, like the later stuff, he's not in it as much, but they'll be like, no.
Like they just have like, at one point one of the characters goes, man, this is really interesting. You know, this is life or death. What would Bakugo do? I wonder what he's doing. And they just shoots a shift over to what he's doing. So while All Might is trying to meet up with Professor David, who's a guy who doesn't have any superpowers. He's just like kind of like a Tony Stark type guy. He like makes items and stuff. While he's like oddly evasive and not seeing All Might because he's working on some project, Deku like meets his daughter and they... And she's also a person who has no powers. She's just a super scientist. They make friends, and then Deku runs into the rest of the gang and finds out why most of them are there. Oh, and the Lightning Kid is there. And the Sticky Balls Kid. Those are not popular characters that somehow tag along and are in the adventure. They're like working some like cheesy like waiter job and they get sucked into the adventure. But yeah, they all meet her and they all like, oh, she's hot. So Deku must be like in love with her. And they're just friends. And so stuff happens and these guys raid the island and all the heroes get caught. And the only ones who aren't are Deku and the gang, and they have to free all the major heroes from the security system from the island that's keeping them in place, and then go and defeat the big bad guy, and you learn what's actually going on. It was a pretty good movie. I mean, it had some good action sequences. They tried to make that, well, the, you know, kids had some part where they got to use their powers effectively, and so because it's a anime original movie, it's very much supposed to be a plot cul-de-sac where nothing super vital happens. So if you're like, why don't they ever mention this again, it won't come up again. Or, like, it wouldn't be odd that they'd never mention this again. But, in my humble opinion, and this is so pedantically nerdy, but please let me have this. They do, in my opinion, kind of mess that up. Because the girl invents this like, she sees that, because there's, like, this little game where you can play to, like, win prizes and points. And Bakugo makes a big deal that he, like, beat it so quickly. And they all pressure Deku into doing it. And he, like, just falls short. And the girl, Melissa, sees, oh, he has a power that, like, hurts himself. So she makes him this gauntlet that, like, reduces that. And it's basically there so Deku can go all out in the fight scenes. And, like, fight alongside All Might against the big boss character. And so they don't have to worry about him hurting himself or him having to be healed, because there wouldn't be anybody to heal him, which is all fine, and it makes, you know, some, you know, exciting fight sequences. But the first thought I had, even like while the movie was going on, is how they're gonna explain why this girl who's friends with Deku, and you know, she doesn't die, and you know, they don't have any bad blood at the end. Hey, I made you a bunch of those gauntlets. Here's like a box of them. There weren't that. I made this one up pretty quickly. I mean, I was already kind of working on something like this, but I just modified a little for you. Why couldn't I make more of these and send them to you in a box? And I mean, obviously, we know why that is, but they have no explanation. They just expect you not to notice that.
Just don't pay too much attention. Okay. They should have at least thrown in something like, this was so hard to make that I could only make one. Or
yeah, whatever. No, it's like, oh, yeah, or I had to use a shard of unobtainium, and like, how, when am I ever going to see unobtainium again? Because at least then, if they did like a second movie and they brought back that girl, they could be like, oh, I got a second shard of unobtainium. Because the gauntlet gets destroyed, but once again, since there is no unobtainium, she should just be able to crank those puppies out.
That's a good point.
But yeah, no, it's a fun movie filled with action. You know, if you liked any of the characters that I mentioned, like, they do have a bunch of, like, little cameos. Of some other people down the island. Frog Girl is there, the Shadow Guy, Sugar Rush for some reason. But they're all locked down by the security system, and by the time they're free, it doesn't super matter. And so they're just there, so you can go, oh, that's my favorite character! But yeah, they appear in the movie, like, for 30 seconds. Like, the Acid Girl and the Invisible Girl are also in there. They're, like, in the same room as Frog Girl. But they do nothing.
Okay. Got some questions. Mm-hmm. So, first, was this written by the original mangaka, or who, was he involved in it?
Not that I saw. I can't say for certain. It wasn't one of those movies where they had like a little interview at the end, and I didn't like research too carefully. I do know Jump has been putting in the authors more so that the movies aren't complete and utter, you know, filler garbo, but I don't know if that's the case in this one.
And so this was a limited engagement movie screening, right?
Yeah, it was only for like, I think they played it a few times. I remember like Anime News Network and Crunchyroll saying that it broke like a decent amount of records for, you know, for the limited release. So I think it did pretty well, and I think they added some extras. I definitely remember them adding some extra screenings, but yeah, it was definitely like a Fathom event, only a few days, and I don't even think it was like 2 weeks or something like that. I think it was like Tuesday, Thursday for 2 weeks, and then they added like a third week.
So how busy was the screening you were in?
We went, and I remember at least one of the screenings was sold out, and we got there early because my roommate really likes to get good seats. And so for a while there wasn't a lot of, and they let us go in early. So for a while it wasn't filled, but by the time the movie started, if there were any free seats, there weren't that many.
And I assume it was subtitled.
Yes.
And so what?
There was a dubbed version as well, but we didn't go to see that one. But there was basically dub nights and sub nights. And I know, like, the first sub night we missed out on.
And did the crowd react during the movie, or?
So, actually, that's interesting. So, you could definitely tell who were, like, the popular characters. So, like, actually, me and my roommate were having a discussion about how, like, old we've gotten. Because, like, most of the people there were younger. And just the amount of screaming and yelling and like happened. So when anybody who was popular showed up, there was, especially for the first time, there was a lot of screaming. Once again, I think Bakugo got the most. And man, also did we learn that there is, you would think you were at a screening a fairy tale for how thirsty some of these kids were.
Oh god.
Also, who's the kid who has the hard skin?
I mean, I know who you're talking about. I don't remember his name. Yeah. Bakugo's buddy.
Bakugo's buddy. Whenever him and Bakugo did anything that could be slightly conceived as helping shipping, oh my god. Did the audience go nuts?
I have no idea. Okay.
So, yeah, no. They, I don't know if the, we were actually trying to figure out, like, if That is not a popular pairing in the manga. It is definitely among the anime fans, especially the American anime fans, because they ate that up with a spoon. Like, some of the other people or pairings got like a little reaction, but that by far, because they loved Bakugo, and Bakugo and his buddy together, especially if anything even was slightly suggestive, I'm sure that people in the other theaters are like, what is going on in that theater? Also, anytime All Might did anything cool, the audience went pretty much almost as crazy as Bakugo friendshipping.
That's nice.
And Deku, actually probably just a little bit below All Might, but I feel like, especially when you see the fandom over Bakugo, you could assume that maybe it's a Bleach situation where everybody likes the side characters and you're like, oh, Ichigo exists. But no, they really seem to be rooting on Deku because he pretty much got as much excitement and hype as when All Might was doing cool things. So I don't feel he's like a hated or like, I guess he's their main character, which is interesting. But yeah, no, those were the like standout. But yeah, no, it was definitely a raucous audience. But yeah, you could definitely tell like how popular people were by just how many screams people got when they did their cool thing. This episode's food for thought.
So, since we were just talking about My Hero Academia, it's a perfect segue into our food for thought, which is just
Your most popular ship?
Yeah, we could do that. I mean, I think that would be a very popular write-in question. I don't really have one, but that would make it difficult. But if we just make things up that'll either entice or upset people, we could do that. But we thought we could just talk about some of our favorite characters, especially because last time we talked about My Hero Academia, I was reading the manga, Al was watching the anime, and the anime hadn't introduced like a whole bunch of the cast yet, which has now been introduced. So we'll do that after the break.
Listen to our song!
ほどに靴底が汚れてくそんな風に僕らの魂も擦り減れば欠けてしまうよそんな時に思い出して君が諦められない理由を救ったはずが救われたけ
What's your answer to the food for thought? We will talk about the far less controversial and possibly less popular, who is your favorite character or characters from My Hero Academia.
So, I want to hear from you, Al, because last time I spoke, I talked a bit about the big three, or like I alluded to them, but they hadn't appeared yet, so I didn't want to talk about them a whole heck of a lot. But two of my favorite characters are our third years. I love Sun Eater, especially just his his gloom brings something really special to the table. And then I love Millions. So I think that's a character that I didn't really expect them to introduce kind of late into the story, but I think he adds a really interesting dynamic with him and Deku.
So, I think I'm going to pick a weird choice.
Wait, but I want to hear what you think of the third years first.
The third years, I feel like Millions is the only one we super meet. In the anime anyhow, because we see his power and we get a little bit of an idea of how he thinks when he interacts with Deku, and then he has that fight against everybody, and he's the one who talks the most during the introduction of the big three. The girl starts off talking a lot, but then she kind of fades away and lets Millions talk. And then the other guy, very specifically, is super nervous and doesn't talk a lot. So we don't know any of their powers. And it seems very deliberate to just give you enough so you're curious about them, but not enough to really get a super feel of them.
Well, I'm here to make you more curious because they're great, okay? They're super great. You can't wait to see them in a big story. It's going to happen soon.
So I feel like I can't super weigh in on them. I feel like the author very deliberately is holding back on them at this point. I'm sure whenever the next season starts, I'll have a more firm grasp of who they are, what they can do, and all that. But and even Millions seems to still have a lot of stuff about him that we don't know. So they make a big deal that he's you gotta keep your eye on this guy. So I feel like I can't make any kind of judgment on him until that shoe drops, as it were.
Okay, now you may tell us your favorite.
I'm actually gonna go with Tenya Ida, the class president. I think he serves an interesting role in the series of kind of being a counterbalance to the rest of the class. And I liked his story with the brother and Stain and all that. And I feel like he balances them out well. I know you mentioned that he doesn't appear a lot in the later, or it's definitely in the next arc, and as far as you can tell for a while.
I mean, everybody appears. They just don't have a big role to play.
Yeah, they're not main characters. They're more secondary characters at that point.
Yes.
But yeah, I thought he just adds a good dynamic to the series. And I like that, he has the interesting non-romantic dynamic with Ochako and Deku. I think they could have made that into a love triangle or something like that, which would have been uninteresting or unnecessarily complicated. I like that.
Ships got brought up after all, yo!
But I like how there basically is no ship. He's just a good friend.
So says you.
Sure. Your 12-part fanfic about their love triangle, I'm sure, is extremely compelling. But I'm talking about canon here, Kate. And you're like, no, my fanfiction is canon.
How dare you say someone's ship is not canon?
The ship ain't canon. Done. But yeah, I think he can be underappreciated for what he brings to the story. The most fascinating news and conversations from this month. We are going to be talking about our first weekend of October and our activities. Technically, there was one con we went to. It was technically two cons, but there was New York Comic Con, which we have been attending for several years. And as we mentioned, this seemed like a very critical year for a lot of our determining of whether we were going to come back. And part of that reason
is because there was technically a second con, which was a New York Anime Festival that was running in a separate site, which we did not attend, but I feel like we just have to address on this podcast for various reasons, and because this is an anime and manga podcast.
And it was part of New York Comic Con. It was an extra ticketed event. They have done a lot of these types of things over the last couple of years as New York Comic Con grows, but usually they're sort of single night events, not a whole other portion to the convention, more like talks with certain authors at a special venue, stuff like that. This was a whole 4-day extra section of anime and manga content.
And it was interesting because there was a little speculation of, would this be totally the anime ghetto and would all the New York Comic Con, you know, anime-related content just be segregated into that section? And it turned out it wasn't, which on one hand was good for us because we got to see a lot of great things at New York Comic Con. But on the other hand, it was weird because there was some stuff they played in both places. There was some stuff that was only at New York Anime Festival. So if you didn't have that extra, you know, those extra tickets, then you didn't get to see that. And so, definitely not all the anime content was there, but enough to be weird, confusing, and annoying.
Yeah, and so, again, I just want to reiterate that we did not attend Anime Fest. We were going to talk about some reactions that we saw to it, an article, and we went to feedback panel where some people spoke about it. But neither of us ever set foot there. We did not buy extra tickets because for two real reasons, I think. One, they announced it after the sale of tickets for New York Comic Con. And so as people who have gone to New York Comic Con previous years, we got to order tickets earlier than the general admission or whatever for New York Comic Con. So tickets were already bought, which for 4 days at Comic Con is way over $100 at this point. So to add anything on top of that is just a huge amount of money. And at the same time, it also felt there wasn't very much information about it, so it wasn't clear what you would really be getting by paying that extra money.
And it was a significant distance away. It was 18 blocks away, which is not, you know, even stuff like Madison Square Garden and the Hammerstein Theater are not close, but they're not anywhere near that far away. So it's not like one of those things where you could just stop in for a panel or two. You basically were like, all right, I'm leaving pretty much Con X to go to the other one for the day.
Yeah, and I guess there was a shuttle to this, but at feedback it came up that it was like super unclear that was even in existence, where to get it at the con, from Javits anyway. I guess, you know, obviously once you did get it, you'd know where it was or whatever, but that the information was not, you know, readily available for that.
A lot of the pictures I saw on Thursday and Friday from various people made it seem like a ghost town. And from the ADN report, that was apparently the case. In fact, a whole bunch of artists and dealers just left, decided to cut their losses after the first day. Apparently, also from the report, Saturday and Sunday, there was a distinct uptick. It was, you know, was definitely not bursting at the seams, but it was no longer, you know, just tumbleweeds and a few people walking around.
And that makes sense to me. The anime crowd is a little bit younger. This is not a summertime con, so school is in session for both college students and high school students. So kind of makes sense to me that those other 2 days would have been pretty light on attendance. I feel as though Anime NYC probably sees the same thing.
They just have much bigger adult attendance. But, I mean, I think also when, like, a light New York Comic Con day apparently was very different in feel than a light New York Anime Festival feel.
So at con feedback, like I said, somebody brought up the shuttle, a few other things about this con came up, mostly that people were really mad that the timing of announcing it, the price, what was supposed to be going on there. And I felt that the staff for New York Comic Con, I didn't feel like they gave very good answers for some of these questions that people had. And I also thought there was some kind of contradictory information being said by the crew, which was, you know, first they asked, oh, was there anything that was happening at Anime Fest that wasn't happening at New York Comic Con? And then people brought up, well, there was some autograph signings at Anime Fest that were only there. And they had its own artist alley, so, you know, that was specific to them. Nobody brought this up, but I remember that there was a bunch of screenings that were at only at Anime Fest. But then the crew was like, well, we tried to put the big things in both places. But then I thought in my mind, I thought, well, then why would I pay to go to Anime Fest? Like on the one hand, you're saying, hey, we still have anime and manga content at New York Comic Con, which, great, that's what I want. But we also have the same anime and manga content at Anime Fest. So, like, if I had paid money to go there, wouldn't I be, like, more upset? Mm-hmm. Because on top of my... Like, now the thing is with Anime Fest, you can choose just to go there. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what they're hoping more for than for people at New York Comic Con to also go to Anime Fest. I mean, maybe that's their idea. I just felt like it was kind of weird and not... I didn't think they knew what they wanted to do with it.
Yeah, no, and I think also it felt like to me, and this is my speculation, but it felt like a lot of the big anime and manga events and guests, or more importantly, the companies that brought them over were like, hey, you can't spring this New York Anime Festival thing and ask us to go over there. You know, this is Cowboy Bebop, or this is Harold the Beckeye, or this is...
Dragon Ball.
Dragon Ball. We came here because we expected to get New York Comic Con eyeballs, not this little, you know, anime ghetto numbers.
Yeah, so it'll be very interesting to see kind of what they take away from this, if they're going to do this again. I don't really get it. I don't really see what it's providing. Unless the idea is that people will just buy tickets to that convention. Because going to New York Comic Con, I saw plenty of anime and manga content. It's not the only thing that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I got lots of anime and manga content, I feel like, out of New York Comic Con. So I didn't feel like I needed to then invest in this, especially just on top of, you know, what's going on at New York Comic Con, plus Anime NYC that's happening in a month.
Yeah. No, it's just, if it was an attempt to make a new, further way anime ghetto, I feel like didn't succeed, because there were still as many anime kiddies at New York Comic Con as there ever were. Otherwise, it seems really confusing of, like, what was the purpose of this?
Okay, so moving on to the actual convention that we did attend.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I feel like I saw a lot of anime and manga content. I mean, obviously we had all of the company booths were really done up big at this con, but we also got things like Cowboy Bebop 20th anniversary panel, which was, you know, a lot of fun because it had both English and Japanese staff.
And it felt like it was some staff that we haven't seen before. I mean, Daisato has been... He's actually not that uncommon a anime convention guest. And apparently he's also been to Japan Expo. He mentioned that during the Q&A. But I don't think I remember when Otakon had the panel, I don't think they had, like, cool script writing lady or the character designer or the mecha designer. And they were all new.
I can't remember. I think that the woman, the scriptwriter, she said that she had never been. Mm-hmm. She also went to Japan Expo, I believe. I think it was this year, but that she had never been before, other than that. So, like, this and that were, you know, like, her experience of it. Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, a lot of the panel was everybody congratulating everybody for being awesome, which was, like, it's just so nice to see a bunch of creators being appreciative of other talent. And I think it did end on a pretty sad note, though, because they were talking about, it was all canned questions, throwing that out there, so.
Which was weird, not because obviously they just wanted to, you know, control what questions rabid Cowboy Bebop fans would ask them, but some of the questions they asked were like, aren't these the cringy questions that you used canned questions to avoid, like the is Spike dead and is there gonna be a sequel?
The sequel one was what I was alluding to, because it kind of ended on a sad note because the staff was sort of talking about, like, oh, like, could you follow it up or could you do anything? And, like, oh, well, we need all the staff to be together. And then it was talking about how Jet's Japanese voice actor passed away just like a month or two ago. And they had recently been to his memorial service. So it was kind of, you know, it's brought up all these, like, feelings about how they're not all together anymore and they couldn't do this. So I thought that was, like, you know, it was like a melancholy moment, but at the same time I feel like that's so, it's almost like quintessential Bebop to end on a melancholy note. And yeah, Spike is freaking dead. Why was that a question? I didn't even know that there was any debate in anywhere about that.
For some reason, I do know that, like, recently people have come up with all these weird, strange fan theories about how Spike isn't dead at the end of Cowboy Bebop, and how there are, like, plenty of hints about it.
No, there aren't.
Look, Shane, I didn't say it was sane. I just said it's this weird, like, I feel, well, as I mentioned when we were discussing it before, I feel like it's the reverse of they were actually dead the whole time theories. The, he's actually alive theory.
I thought you were just going to say that Spike is the cart driver.
Nah. He's the bird that flies off at the end.
Makes sense.
Well, the only other thing I want to mention about the panel is one of the questions was, like, what was everybody's favorite episodes or episodes that, like, affected them the most? And one, the lady who voiced Julia and was the dub, like, in charge of the dub direction, picked the most American answer that there could be, which was Mushroom Samba. All she didn't do was go, 420 for life, woo! While saying it. And then the Japanese answers were, like, really weird because they're not any of, like, the popular episodes. Because one of them was Wild Horses, which is, like, in running with the Jet episodes to be the most old man episode of Cowboy Bebop. It's the one with, like, the old space shuttle and Spike going to get his, you know, his spaceship fixed from, like, this old guy and his young assistant. And then Daisato's answer was Brain Scratch, which, as I mentioned in the Cowboy Bebop Rewatch podcast, like, one of the few episodes I've actually seen people strongly dislike. And it was special to him because it got him, like, Kenji Kamiyama saw that and asked him to work on Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex because of his work on Brain Scratch. So it felt like it opened up a lot of doors for him. But yeah, it was just not the episodes I was expecting anyone to pick. On the Japanese side, I definitely expect that.
Americans always pick that one.
Yeah. I think the other big anime and manga thing, I went to the Harold Sakauchi panel. He did Back Mongolian Chop Squad. He's currently doing Seven Shakespeares. Comixology brought him over. And yeah, they did like a little bit of a canned Q&A, just more as an introduction to him, just in case you didn't know his career. And And then they opened up for Q&A. We also, me and my roommate, went to the Kodansha panel. Harold was not there, but his editor was there. And he answered a few questions just about being an editor in general. And that was pretty informative. Most people asked Beck questions. I think I'd say about 80% of the questions were Beck questions. Or if they were not directly Beck questions, they were like tangentially Beck questions, like what kind of music is he into and this such. And then I asked pretty much most of the non, like either Seven Shakespeares, or he talked a lot about his assistants. So I asked him a little bit about his assistants. And he mentioned like one of them is currently doing this manga that seemed very Kate about a time-traveling delinquent.
Yes!
But it was not the time-traveling delinquent manga that Kodansha just licensed. It was a different one.
Okay, I didn't know that they licensed a time-traveling delinquent manga, but clearly it should have been this one. But is that a new genre that I was not aware of? Because hook a sister up.
Kate's just like, auto-subscribe me to all your time-traveling delinquent manga.
Bring it.
And one of his other assistants was doing like the manga adaptation of like an existing property. I don't remember what it was. I thought it was interesting. He's like, they're all weird people, but most people who go into the manga industry are weird people. It's almost just like assistants are like larval state weird people, and they just get weirder as they go pro.
That's a great answer.
There were some prizes to like the best questions. Since I asked all the Seven Shakespeare questions, he was working on a sketch of for the Seven Shakespeares, so he gave that to me.
That is so amazing.
So he had seven characters on it, but he only inked in the ones that were released in the books that are on Comixology. And he's like, these characters are characters that are like, you know, will eventually be in the series.
That is such a cool thing to get, to have. That's amazing.
Because I thought, like, I like was going to leave to go to signing. And like, oh, and then I didn't realize what booth it was. And then, because I thought he was still working on it. And then he's like, oh, no, I'm done. Because I only, and then he explained to me why he only filled in, like, four of the characters. And he was like, because these are only the characters that have been introduced. So I thought it was cool. And the other prize was to a Kindle. I think she was the only person who didn't ask a Beck question. She asked about his work with publishers in general. Because he's worked for different publishers. How, like, they've all differed, and he mentioned a little bit about like kind of the vibe at different manga publishers he's worked at.
And what was his autograph signing like? Was it busy?
There must have been about 30 people and then a few people back of me. He would either sign the booklet, because Comixology had like the original manga program, or they had Beck pins. They had the dog from Beck. And I got Kate a signed Beck pin.
That was a very nice surprise.
He seemed, he like signed six pins for one guy because he was getting pins for his whole manga club. So, he basically...
That's so sweet.
So he was like, yeah, just give me all six names. Here we go.
Well, that's really nice. I mean, we've seen him at a con before, so this is... But it was, like, such a long time ago at this point that it's nice to have, like, a repeat.
Yeah, I think it was, like, one of our first Anime Nexts, if I remember correctly. Back when they were, you know, at the Meadowlands.
That was, like, so many years ago.
Yeah.
I don't even want to think about how many years ago that was.
The thing now that I think about it, the funny thing is, do you remember the question that I asked him at Anime Next?
Yes, Al. No, of course not.
Oh, the question I asked him was like, how is it working with your editor? and he like got really sheepish and he's like, oh, we didn't announce it, but the guy who's like sitting to the right of me is my editor, so I'm only gonna have good things to say about working with him. It's great. He's a wonderful man. Working with him is beautiful every day. I just remember because now they made a big deal to announce that like the guy sitting there was his editor. But I just, it, talking about his editor reminded me that that was the question I asked him.
So, like I said earlier, they're all the big, or most of the big companies had booths at on the New York Comic Con show floor. So Viz was there, Funimation was there.
Kodansha Vertical had a joint booth.
And Yen Press had a sort of a very small booth that was within Hachette's publishing area. I think One Piece Books was there.
Yeah. They were just in the indie comic section, not in like the big, like flashy section.
And you know, Kodansha and Viz both had, like, exclusive stuff that you could buy only at Comic-Con, that sort of thing. So there was plenty to see, like, on that front. Nobody had super crazy booths. You know, I think it was it last year when Viz brought all the signboards?
Yeah, I think that was 2 years ago, but maybe last year.
Yeah, you know, I feel as though a lot of the booths to me, except for the Dragon Ball booth, which, of course, we've seen at all the cons now, has, like, the dragon and all the Dragon Ball Z statues and everything. But I did feel that everybody's booths were a little calmer, I guess you could say. They weren't crazy.
And I did notice that I feel like the video game presence has distinctly gone down. There's still video game companies that show up, but I think that also has to do with a lot more with PAX and the such just becoming more ubiquitous, so they have more places to, more conventions to basically show off what they have, especially in a video game focused setting as opposed to general nerd con. So I do feel like, I remember like the first few years, there was just that always super loud section of video games, whereas, yeah, even there's less of them and they're a lot more low key.
I still think there was a lot to see and do. It didn't feel as if the show floor was, you know, empty in any particular way. But yeah, I just felt like maybe booths have just dialed it down just like a couple of notches. And I think there wasn't, I didn't feel there was a huge movie presence this year.
Yeah, you know what I did see a lot more of? Like, kind of nerdy or nerd-related, like Hulu or like online streaming things that seem to be the more present thing. Like, you wouldn't see, like, they seem to save like the big movie stuff for San Diego Comic-Con. Here they seem to be like The Boys, whatever that DC thing is. Good Omens, they had a lot for that.
More TV.
Yeah,
you're right. Yeah, they had a, I really liked, they had a school bus for Heathers, the mini series that they're doing, but I couldn't, from the just seeing the bus, I was like, what station is this on? I still don't know because I haven't bothered to look it up, but I was like, where can I watch this? And you got to see the new Doctor Who?
Yes, I saw the new Doctor Who. I was going to, just figure. Might as well talk a little about that. They have the 13th Doctor, 13th official full Doctor. We won't go into obscure lore things. Anyhow.
You guys couldn't see the look I was giving Al.
But she's the first official female doctor. There have been a few non-canonical or joke female doctors. But she is the first fully official female doctor. And so they simulcast the episode at New York Comic Con in England and on BBC America. And so I got to see that. Jodie Whittaker was very solid. I thought she put in a good performance. The episode itself seemed a little introductory, but I think a lot of that was on purpose. And I feel like I want to reserve a little bit of judgment, because they very deliberately seemed to make her character a little malleable, to let Jody kind of determine a little bit how she wants to play the character as it goes on. So, because she, like, is a little jarred from her regeneration, and, like, it takes her a while to even remember her name. So I feel like if she wants to play the character a little differently, or, you know, it unfolds, it's a pretty big character, and I feel like a lot of eyes are on her because she's the first female doctor, and there's a lot of expectations on her because she's the first female doctor. So I think they've given her room to kind of grow into the character, and to find her own voice. I think in the next few episodes will solidify her character, but so far she seemed, she had good energy, she played off the companions well, she was kind of bold, a little funny, she actually made her own sonic screwdriver, so she was a little more handy than previous doctors. She herself was great. The companions, I was a little, they were given a little less time. The one kid with the muscular disability, he got, like, a little more focus and backstory. I felt like he got the most, so you got a really good idea of who he was. The other two characters definitely will grow throughout the season. You basically want to focus on one of the companions, on the doctor. The alien, he was, like, basically the threat of the episode. He was kind of basically like a bootleg predator. But he was also a cheater because he was there for, like, an initiation test and he was cheating. It's clear he'll be back later in the season. It wasn't a bad episode. It just felt very... I'm waiting for... Because the main problem people have had with the last few seasons is they felt like it felt... The last few seasons and the Moffat fell into a formula that people weren't enjoying anymore. And so... how they're going to structure the whole season. This was very kind of one-off episode, except for that alien was clearly going to come back. So it has yet to be seen how the writing team is going to do. That's what I'm holding off judgment, to see how they basically structure things past this. But, I mean, if they give Jodie Whittaker good scripts, I feel like it was encouraging. I think she can knock it out of the park past that point. So I'm willing to see where they go with her. She seems like a fun doctor.
And you said you felt like it was very introductory, but I do think that for a lot of people, this might end up being their first Doctor Who, because I think the announcement of it being a woman seemed to bring a bunch of people either back to it or get them kind of interested in it. So kind of makes sense to me that it would be, not that I've watched like one episode, a random episode of Doctor Who my whole life, so I don't know anything about it really, but seems like it makes sense to me to make it a little more introductory.
Yeah, no, I felt like it didn't feel like a big grand production, but like you said, I think you just want to get people settled in. Hey, if this is maybe a little disconcerting, Doctor, let's start it off simple. If you're new to Doctor Who, let's start it off simple. And it wasn't an unpleasant episode at all. And as I said, I look forward to watching more. Just I'm gonna reserve before I say, oh, everybody should watch. Because once again, this writing team is all new, and so I'm curious to see what they do beyond this point.
For me, I think my biggest event of New York Comic Con was getting to see the cast of Critical Role. Not their live show. They did a live show on Thursday. I did not get to go to that, but they did a panel on Sunday where, you know, it was just them answering questions from the audience and being really hilarious with each other. So I was really pleased to do that. I've only recently really become a fan of the series, and me being, I don't know, somehow I didn't know how big it was until I, like, went to New York Comic Con, because I started listening to this I listened to it as a podcast, and I didn't really start listening to it until some random person on a random blog mentioned it. So it wasn't, I didn't come at it from a big news source or something where it's talking about how popular it is or something. So I was kind of caught off guard, but I'm still able to get in there okay and, enjoy them. And it wasn't so big that there was no way I was going to get to see them, I guess. But it was in main events, so I did have to put in some extra effort to get there. And they were a hilarious group. If you're not familiar with them, they play D&D live on Twitch, and there's a lot of those right now, and it has become a pretty popular thing to do, but they are maybe one of the biggest, or the biggest, I don't really know, group that is doing it, and they've, recently got their own studio, so, it's just getting bigger, and it seems to be getting bigger and bigger for them.
I mean, I noticed a tip out, I don't know if you noticed, but a tip out 1 out of 10, maybe 1 out of 12 people in the audience had some kind of Critical Role shirt or item on them. So, I mean, obviously the audience of the Critical Role panel, that's going to be higher than the rest of the convention, but that's still pretty, that's like going to a Dragon Ball event and 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 12 people wearing some kind of Dragon Ball memorabilia on them.
And there were people cosplaying as their characters in their D&D campaign. There's tons of fan art of their characters and stuff like that. So it was really great. I really liked seeing everybody talk about the characters, and I feel like I learned a lot about them just because I don't also follow the careers of all these voice actors. And obviously they're all very active in their communities and stuff, but since I don't really know that about them, I felt like I learned a lot. Maybe people who already knew them were like, yeah, of course, whatever. But I felt like I got to know the cast.
I did find it interesting, the little section of what not to ask, because it was clear, once again, they were like, no, you can't have us do voice actor lines. One of them plays the cowboy from Overwatch, who I can't remember. So, no asking him what time it is, even if it's high noon.
The video that they made beforehand was really good, yeah.
It was interesting, because apparently it just comes up so much that they've done a whole separate series, but no, asking GMing tips. Just ask, if you ask a GM question, it has to be about the Critical Role series. So no, how do I get my players out of this situation or something like that? We have a separate, weekly or, monthly podcast about that. So listen to that if you will, or write into that thing if you want that. Because, yeah, I think if they hadn't said that, there probably would have been, some role-playing, questions like that. I thought that was interesting that they basically cut both of those types of questions off at the pass.
And I felt one, that they did cut it off, but they did it in a really funny and humorous way that made you feel like if you were going to ask that they weren't hating on you for doing it. And then it also, I think it resulted in an overall better panel because everything was really kind of focused on, some people asked about campaign 1, some people asked about campaign 2, but I felt like it was really honed the questions in a way that I don't know if I've ever appreciated it in, because, it's certain, anime panels, production panels, to be you can only ask about this one anime, and that really frustrates me. But for some reason, at this Critical Role panel, where it was essentially you need to ask questions only about this thing, was fine, and I really liked it.
But I feel like, if anything else, how many episodes has Critical Role had? Over 100?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like you have over 100 episodes plus side content, all those, ask a DM and questions like that, which I feel like only add to the amount of content. And I feel like, and it was sold up front. It wasn't like the panel was come and see you know,
just the name of the creator. Yeah.
And then, you know, and everybody wants to ask about their 10 old series. And like, sorry, you can only ask about this one paycheck series that he just did.
That's true. I do think also these particular actors are also like you kind of implied, Al, they're just more readily available for, they go to lots of cons, they're online a lot, so you can ask them questions there, so that that making this a more focused panel really worked. So I had a great time. I laughed really hard. I learned a lot about my favorite character, Caleb. Thought it was great. Really wish I could have seen the live show. I think that would have been a lot of fun.
It seemed like it was on a boat.
What?
The live show.
No. The characters were on a boat.
Oh, okay. I thought that there was on a boat, but I thought they were like, ha-ha, we'll do a cruise thing.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I'm pretty sure no.
Okay.
Just the part of the story, they're on a boat now. And the name, here, you like this, Al. So the name of the boat that they accidentally didn't mean to, but then ended up stealing. So sounds like a D&D party, right? was called the Mist, and they needed to rename it. So now it's called the Mistake. Yeah, really delightful. If you've never listened, you know, I do highly recommend it. Even having, like I said, not really following or caring that these are voice actors. I mean, they're great at what they're doing, but I didn't even need that to enjoy, you know, like, it's still really fun. And so that kind of brings me actually to something that we talked about a bit on the ride home from the last day of the con, which is, do you need to go to 4 days of New York Comic Con anymore? I think this was like a big topic for us.
I mean, Pat's friend of the blog is staying over, and he just asked me the same question, because I feel like it's not even on our minds. I feel like it's on a lot of people's minds that, like, as the ticket price goes up, as it gets harder every year to get tickets, or these get tickets for all 4 days, you know, essentially, you've got to be in it to win it to get the, if you want to go all 4 days.
But, so I feel like show floor wise, Artist Alley, which we didn't really talk about, but it was great this year. They moved it. It was fantastic.
It wasn't in the Trolls Dungeon anymore.
So, like, high praise for that. Like, I feel as though, in that sense, I could probably go, like, 1 day or 2 days and really get what I wanted out of, say, the show floor in the Artist Alley. But the thing is, so even if I say that, right, if I had not gone on Sunday, I would have missed the thing that I would have wanted to see most.
Yeah, no, I mean, the problem is, if I didn't go Thursday, I wouldn't have seen the Cowboy Bebop panel. If I didn't go Saturday, I wouldn't have gotten that sketch. Going Friday, let me see the Venture Brothers panel, which was really funny. And other than me not getting cake, but that was definitely worth it. And I think Sunday was just a fun chillax day. So
you didn't see Doctor Who on Sunday?
And I saw Doctor Who on Sunday. So I felt like the problem is you never know when you get the tickets what you might be missing out on. And especially with any of the anime and manga content, since it's considered lesser, it could be on any of the days. Like, the big Doctor Who style, you know, big Marvel stuff, if you're into that, you pretty much know you can go Saturday, Sunday and see it. But with a lot of the stuff that we see, they tend to throw it on Thursdays and Fridays. And thereby, if you just go, like, Friday, Saturday, or just Saturday, Sunday, you have a decent chance of missing out. Because I remember, weren't all the big manga guests for, like, the last 2 years only Thursday, Friday?
I can't even remember.
I generally remember them being very Thursday, Friday for the last few years.
And also, if you say only go on Thursday, you're probably guaranteed to miss out on big things because the bigger things, but you don't know if those big things are going to be of your interest on the weekend. But also, Thursday's such a great day to go because it's the least busy. everything is nice and shiny and new, and it's a great time to really walk around and get a feel for everything, I think.
Whereas, as I mentioned, Sunday was the day that, like, frantic parents were there to, like, all right, my kids are here. I must take in 4 days of Comic-Con in one day. Because I think I, overheard, like, 3 parents just be like, all right, either to, like, their friends or their spouse, like, we gotta do this.
To pick up on what you're saying, Al, too, something I thought was very interesting from the feedback panel that I didn't really ever consider was, so of course at feedback, now that there's no 3 or 4 day badges, of course it came up, like, hey, are you guys gonna bring back 3 or 4 day badges? And surprisingly, the answer was, we're not sure, maybe, whereas last year was like a hard no. So one, that was interesting. But the other thing I thought was interesting that I hadn't considered before that they explicitly said or heavily implied was that the crew actually doesn't want you to come all 4 days. Like, they would much rather different people come one day and then every day different people come into that building, because that is better for the vendors, because obviously the more people who are new who come through spend more money. I mean, I spent money every day because, of course, I'm a fucking nerd and we're all nerds and that happens. But I guess they would rather, like, the turnover be much bigger because it's better for the booths.
Mm-hmm.
Which I never even thought about before. Like, I mean, obviously, also, only selling single-day badges helps their bottom line because it's way more expensive to buy them. But I thought that was really the only reason until I heard them say that. And then it made sense to me.
Mm-hmm. No,
yeah. That I had not considered that. But, yeah, it's like, I know a lot of people this year who have in the past gone like all 4 days or at least 3 days were down to 2 days or did like 1 day. And I thought, kind of coming out of the con, I was like, well, I could do that. But then I was like, but I had such a great time. I did go only 3. I didn't go all 4. But I had a fantastic time. I got into every single event and panel that I tried to go to.
I did notice, like, last year, there was, like, 2 or 3 panels that I just had to, like, change where I went because it was all filled up. But, like, as I mentioned on the pre-podcast, I had jury duty the day before, so I didn't take off Thursday and Friday. So I had to go to work and then go to Comic-Con. And I thought I wasn't going to get into that Cowboy Bebop panel because I only arrived, like, a half an hour before it began. But I got a seat in the back, but I got a seat. And I got into the Venture Brothers panel, and I got into all the other panels. Doctor Who was at Madison Square Garden, so there was almost no way I wouldn't get a seat.
But that's the thing, is that they have created spaces where they can now accommodate the amount of people. Because if that Doctor Who panel was in the main events...
Yeah, that would have been a very different story, yeah.
You know, like, main events is now kind of the largest small place that they have, as opposed to, like, the Hammerstein and the Madison Square Garden. Now, I think they still have to update their policies and, like, get those venues on board, because people are still having lots of problems with security and with, like, bringing food and stuff like that into those places.
I mean, my roommate just had an empty bottle and he had to, like, check it and go back afterwards to get his water bottle.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely still work to do with that stuff, but, like, the fact that, yeah, I got into everything I wanted to, Artist Alley was moved and therefore, like, way, 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 way better, which was probably my biggest complaint from last year. There was still anime and manga content. As a huge, huge reader, I was overwhelmed with joy this year by the authors that were there. I got one of my favorite books of all time right now signed. And so, yeah, I was just like, I was kind of going into this year with a little bit of a bad attitude. I will totally admit that. But I don't really have any complaints.
I guess part of me wants to go less days, but part of me is also always paranoid that if I go, all right, I won't go Thursday, and they'll be like, here's Rumukio Takahashi,
here's the
Kenjiro Hada, and half the Typhoon staff. Ah, too bad you didn't go Thursday, dick.
I mean, that's the danger, right? Because it's a lot easier if you don't care about going to panels, which a lot of people don't. And I think that's why the one-day badges really work overall for people, because a lot of people, they just want to go to the show floor and see all the cool stuff.
And maybe they'll rest at a panel once, and it's not even like super important which ones. Like, they'll just be like, ah, I'm tired. All right, it's 3. I'll stop into this one panel. Because I've seen people do that at the Anime Con, which is, they'll be like, all right, they spend most of their day either looking at cosplay or the dealer's room, and they'll just stop in one or two panels, more as a rest break.
And maybe they go to the artist alley, maybe they go to the autographing area, where there's, you know, famous people to get autographs from or whatever, and that's their day. They're not really worried about the content, and so therefore, it doesn't matter which day you go, if that's, you know, how you're spending your con. Yeah, it actually is worse because it's like, oh no, but I like all these things and I want to see all the things. And like the author that I wanted to see, you know, was only signing on Saturday, or like you just don't know what you're going to get. So it is, it's like once you've gone once for all 4 days, it's like sucks you in and you're like, but remember all the things that happened on all the different days? None of those things happened on the other days. So the answer is, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. I think something about maybe how they respond to Anime Fest will possibly factor into my decision.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I want, if I had unlimited time and unlimited money, sure, what the hell. But I might be going on a trip next year. We might not be able to get badges that we could be like, all right, you know what? We're in it to win it. We're going to get badges all 4 days. And then I can't get any badges because nobody I know gets through on the system and we can't buy badges.
That's a good point. I mean, I think, yeah, the rub here is also, Can you go? The attendance this year was over 250,000 people. You know, how much more can there be? And if you're not going with your friends, you know, what the heck is the point of going? And I think, but at the same time, like, I absolutely want to go again. I totally do. Because it's the only con that I go to where I get to celebrate all the other nerdy things that I like throughout the year. We're really focused on anime and manga. Not because we have to be, but because we love it the best. But we also like other things. This is, like, the one time that I go and, like, really do anything related to any of those things. So I don't want to lose that. It's in our backyard, so, like, that makes it easy. And they put on a good show this year. Like, God, can you guys just fuck up really bad and then we won't have to make these decisions? Like, is that what I want? No.
Yeah, no, it'll be an interesting year next year.
Yeah, I thought that I would know after going to this, and I feel like, no, now I don't know at all.
That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit reversethieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.